Hello and welcome to the History of England, episode 23, Subjugation. Can I start with a couple of pieces of housekeeping first before we get on to William the Conqueror? The first thing is that last week, as you probably know by now, my brother and I released a supplementary episode to answer a couple of questions that had come in. And that seems to have confused everybody, so everybody's downloaded that and nobody's downloaded the episode about 1066. Well, I exaggerate for effect, obviously. Now, it could just be, of course, that none of you want to hear any more about 1066. You've heard all that 100 times, you did it at school, so not interested anymore. And if that's the case, that's absolutely fine. But just to say, there were two episodes last week, so it might be as well just to go back and check your libraries. And the second thing was to give a special mention to any of you who are listening to this doing your ironing. I'm told that the History of England is a perfect accompaniment to doing the ironing on a Sunday afternoon. I'm not quite sure what that says about the History of England. But anyway, if you are doing your ironing, thank you for listening, and I hope it's making the ironing go a bit faster. But anyway, back to William the Conqueror. Looking back, it's hard not to feel that William had a rather easy ride after 1066, and England collapsed with surprising ease. Surely we should have expected a heroic struggle over decades with battle after battle before William was finally able to secure his new kingdom. But as we'll see in this week's episode, in fact, he did have to work harder than it might at first appear. But it's also true to say the resistance to the new regime was weak and disjointed, and one of the principal reasons for this is that there's really a lack of credible leaders for the English to rally around. Edgar the Atheling, the man proclaimed but never crowned king, was just 15. All the Godwinson brothers had died at Hastings, and Harold's sons had fled to Ireland or had been captured. The earls Edwin and Morcar might have provided some resistance, but they had no direct claim to the throne, and no one really to unite behind. We talked last week about some of the military advantages the Normans held in cavalry and mobility, but now it was to be the castle that was to be the most significant of their military innovations. The use of castles is so closely associated with the Normans that the chroniclers actually often use the term castlemen when talking about them. We tend to think about castles as defensive structures, but in this context, they were very much used as the basis for offence. Castles allowed the development of a strong point in hostile country, and over the crucial period of the Norman settlement, they made the absolutely essential difference between success and failure. This Norman conquest wasn't about a massive folk movement like the 6th century or the 9th century. The wonder is, actually, that a relatively small number of people managed to dominate a much more numerous local population, and the castle played an absolutely central role in this. In William's reign alone, the Normans may have built over 200 castles, and of these, over 90 were converted to stone and can still be seen. By 1100, there are over 3,000 castles in England. These castles made a massive difference for the Normans, at a time when there was almost no effective technology to overcome them. I guess another reason I'd advance for the relatively easy submission of England is the tradition of kingship and the public relationship between the Anglo-Saxon people and their king. Although he was an alien, William may well have been seen as perfectly legitimate. Anglo-Saxon kings could well be chosen as other than the eldest son, and from other branches of the royal family. We tend to think to see history through a lens that is deeply coloured by nationalism, and forget that nationalism is a largely 19th century concept, and even a basic sense of English patriotism would have been diluted by a greater sense of loyalty to village and region. In passing, by the way, I should admit that I find this particular historical theme, i.e. nationalism, the most confusing of all. So if anyone can direct me somewhere or put me straight, I'd be very delighted. Anyway, the point is that to many English thanes and churls, there was simply a new master in town. We shouldn't by any means downplay the cataclysmic impact of the conquest, and the pain is reflected by the English chroniclers. But initially at least, there was a chance that William could have been accepted as nothing more than a kink in the royal line. To add to that, once William was invested as king, the basic inclination of the lay and ecclesiastical nobility was towards loyalty, order and obedience. People like Edwin and Morcar very probably also thought that this was where their best personal interests lay. There are some indications that Morcar's eventual revolt came once he realised that William was not going to allow him to marry into his family. The experience of Cnut had been of an invader very willing to help the existing nobility share in the rule of the new kingdom, and create a new state that was not dominated by a new nobility, but shared by the old and the new. In the end, this doesn't happen in England under William. The old English nobility is replaced to the most remarkable degree. By the end of William's reign, All the major positions are held by Normans. There are no English earls left. The major landowners are overwhelmingly Norman. This is a topic we'll come back to in more depth later, but it's not immediately obvious that this was William's original intention. There's no doubt that William was driven by his need to reward his followers and his desire to wring as much money as possible from England to feed his avarice. But within those parameters, the signs are that he intended to reach an accommodation and balance between his English and Norman lords. This doesn't happen because, in fact, the leading English earls find it impossible to serve their new master. And in his turn, William was to find them deeply untrustworthy. And to return to that general feeling that England was conquered rather easily, in fact, the history of the first 10 years of William's reign is one of continual revolt and firefighting. Again, the resistance wasn't coordinated and never really got off the ground. The leaders of the revolts were mainly concerned with their own selfish self-interest, without any wider ambitions or patriotism. But we should have no illusions about the fact that William would never have felt entirely secure in England, and at times would have felt severely threatened. Okay, so let's go back to the new and shiny Westminster, where we left William last week standing for one very rare moment in his life, pale and trembling as his soldiers fire London, mistakenly afraid that the natives had risen in revolt. As I say, his first approach was to work with the local leaders. He was clearly distrustful of the secular leaders like earls and Morcar and Edwin. So they kept their lands, but their position as earls was largely honorary. He demanded hostages from them, and he kept them physically close. But he did seem perfectly willing to rely on the old English ecclesiastical leaders. Stigand remained Archbishop of Canterbury despite the fact that he was clearly in breach of the rules by holding multiple offices and would have been strongly disapproved of by the Norman Church. Eldred, the Archbishop of York, who'd already played the peacemaker, was made Viceroy of Northumbria. Ethelwig, the Abbot of Evesham, and Wulfstan, the Bishop of Winchester, were given a similar position in Mercia. The situation in the far north was much more uncertain. William appointed a man called Copsey, who you may remember from last week as a supporter of Tostig, and he made Copsey Earl of Bamborough. But as soon as he got there, he was quickly dispatched by Oswulf, the descendant of Uhtred of Bamborough, who you will remember from previous episodes. But sometime during 1067, we find a man called Gospatric as Earl in Bamborough. Gospatric seems to be from Scotland, and seemed to have earned his position by offering William lots of cash, something William was particularly partial to. And now William seems to have felt reasonably relaxed about his position. At the start of 1067, he made sure that he'd set up things to his liking. He ordered a castle to be built on the site of the current Tower of London. He made his half-brother Odo the Earl of Kent, and basically put Odo unofficially in charge, and then he set off back to Normandy before Easter 1067. Now this was William's idea of having a good time. He went on a procession through Normandy with the conquered English leaders Stigand, Edwin, Morcar and Edgar the Atheling in tow. He was able to bask in his glory for a while and show everybody just what a great guy he truly was. Before he went, he'd made quite sure that his line of retreat was secure, building castles at Dover and Pevensey. William didn't feel the need to return to England until the end of the year, and it's a pattern that will be repeated for the rest of his life. Normandy was his home and his main priority. England was a sideshow. Back in England, his confidence does seem to have been well placed. There were two hotspots. The first was caused by an Anglo-Saxon thane called Edric the Wild. Edric's motivation for rebellion, like so many others, was to be the removal of some of his lands in Herefordshire by a Norman called Richard Fitzscrob. Edric wasn't having it, and he and some of his Welsh mates attacked Hereford Castle. They had no luck at all in taking the castle, and so they retreated into Wales and spent the next 2 years causing the Normans trouble, without causing them any serious problems, if you see what I mean. The other one was in the southwest, where Harold's mother refused to give up the city of Exeter. Late in the year, William therefore arrived back in England, and must have been pretty pleased at the way things were going. I'd like to bet he'd expected something a bit more dramatic. So he was disposed to be reasonably diplomatic. I mean reasonably on William's scale, rather than on 21st century scale, obviously. He did his normal trick of having some poor citizen mutilated in full sight of the walls, all fairly standard stuff, but when that didn't have the desired effect, he negotiated. Harold's mother Githa sailed away into exile in Flanders, and Exeter had to submit, but with no punitive conditions. William promptly had a castle built and was able to relax again. In April 1068, he felt happy enough to bring his wife Matilda over to join him, and in May she was crowned as his queen in England. Everything looked set, everything looked good. In the background, of course, the real revolution was going on, as steadily the lands held by English thanes were taken over by the Norman invaders. It's difficult to know exactly how fast this happens and precisely what the process was, but because of the Doomsday Survey, we have an extremely good idea of the end result. By 1086, the vast majority of English thanes had been dispossessed of their lands. The numbers are truly staggering. By 1086, 190 lay Norman nobles held 54% of English land. It's difficult to know exactly how far this went down the social scale. The English gave themselves Norman names pretty quickly, as you'd imagine, and many thanes would have become knights. Even if that meant moving down the social scale, and now having to give homage for land they'd previously held as of right. But in terms of land ownership, English names are almost entirely absent from Doomsday. There are only two thanes we are sure continue to hold land directly from the king, a chap called Colswin of Lincoln and Thurkill of Arden. The rest of it was split between Norman barons, the church, and land that William held in his own hands as the king's domain land. The way William did this was to create a number of mega-rich barons, the kind of people who would have appeared in the Sunday Times Rich List. There are about 150 baronies of this kind. The biggest winners, like his half-brother Robert Count of Mortain, ended up with a barony with more than 800 manors. Others of his known companions at Hastings, like Hugh de Grandmesnil, were handsomely rewarded with over 100 manors, right down to relatively modest estates, such as someone called Gilbert de Bretville with 19 manors. In general, these men were simply given the landholdings of existing Anglo-Saxon thanes. This meant that the pattern of landholding was very similar to the existing Anglo-Saxon pattern of landholding, with holdings spread widely throughout the country. There will be exceptions to this that we'll come to at some other time, like the Lords of the Marches. Initially, William probably simply took over the land of the thanes who had died at Hastings, and you can bet there was plenty to go around. But then, as more of the remaining major Anglo-Saxon earls fell foul of him, more lands were added to the pot. But even with this first bunch, picture the scene repeated over all the country, with groups of mailed Norman soldiers appearing in villages, chucking the old thane's family into the street, building a castle, and generally setting up camp. I'd imagine that as this spreads, the dissatisfaction amongst lords grew. This was essentially colonisation. One of the better chroniclers of the age was a chap called Oderic Vitalis, writing in the 12th century, and born of a Norman father and English mother. He says, "Foreigners grew wealthy with the spoils of England, while her own sons were either shamefully slain or driven as exiles to wander hopelessly through foreign kingdoms." Then there's the matter of how the land was held. This was a fantastic, unrivalled opportunity for William to start from scratch and design his new state the way he wanted it. What he does is to make sure that it's absolutely clear that all lands and all rights come from the king. Nobody has any land because it belongs to them. They are simply getting the use of the land in return for a set of military services. This also would have bugged the English. They were used to the idea of allodial land, i.e. land that belonged to them by right. So I think it's important to remember all this background strife bubbling away as we go through the constant rebellion and dissatisfaction of the next few years. Added to that was the personal disappointments of the individuals involved, as they discover that their new king is not going to give them the influence they once had, and that his Norman mates are the ones who really count. And one more thing before I get on with it, the Norman lords themselves also had to adjust. Now in the main they do just fine, don't give them any sympathy, given that now many of them were rich beyond their wildest dreams. But life is not like it was back home. William was very careful to hold on to the central powers of the Anglo-Saxon monarchy, which had been allowed to slip in ducal Normandy. For example, he held on hard to the office of sheriff, with the right to administer justice anywhere, including within the baron's lands. This gets up quite a few Norman noses. He also imposes a much higher level of military service for the land than they were used to in Normandy. Now, I don't think any of these Norman barons were on the breadline, so obviously don't waste any sympathy on the poor poppets, but you know. Okay, so in 1068, things begin to get a little bit hotter. Edwin and Morcar have had enough of being dragged around like lions in a menagerie and raise their standard in revolt. Edgar the Atheling does the same, and Guspatrick, Earl of Northumber, as well. The rebels were clearly getting some support from Malcolm, the King of Scots, who was to be married to Edgar the Atheling's sister Margaret, who herself was later to become canonised as Saint Margaret. Coincidentally, the sons of Harold Godwinson launched a raid from Ireland to the southwest at the same time. This all sounds serious, but you get the impression William hardly broke sweat. He moved fast and struck north with his army, cutting Edwin and Morcar in Mercia off from the north. They quickly apologised to William Sorry, and he forgave them. As he marched north, he established castles at places like Warwick and Nottingham, and by the time he reached York, the revolt had disappeared into nothing. Edgar and Gospatric fled to Malcolm in Scotland. William had bared his teeth, and the rebels had run away. But they'd be back for another go in 1069. William realised that his authority was not yet firmly stamped on Mercia and Northumbria, and he appointed his own man to be Earl, Robert of Comyne. Robert gathered a substantial force of 700 household troops, which you'd have thought would be enough for most emergencies, and set off for the north in January 1069 to Durham. As he travelled, he was met by the Bishop of Durham, Ethelwyn, who came with some friendly warnings. "Look, Robert," he might have said, "just go easy here. Things are still very edgy. You need to be diplomatic, careful, win people round, and look out for treachery and be aware of it." After wondering what the word diplomatic might mean, Robert sent his men in with the hobnail boots with as much sensitivity as a bull in a china shop. They generally set about alienating the locals, to the point of murdering a few of them just for good measure. All of which ensured that Ethelwyn's warnings had been justified. The Northumbrians exploded into violence and set about murdering Robert's men. Despite Ethelwyn's warnings, Robert was taken completely by surprise, in the confidence that Norman soldiers would be able to cope with whatever the despised Anglo-Saxons could throw at them. And they paid the price. "So great," recorded Roger of Hoveden, "was the multitude of the slain that nearly every spot in the city was filled with blood. Only one Frenchman escaped. Robert himself took refuge in the bishop's house. The rebels couldn't storm the place, so they simply torched it, and Robert and his men were burned alive." By this stage, Ethelwyn, disgusted by Robert's stupidity and arrogance, had switched sides, and he sent messages to Gospatric and Edgar in Scotland and closed Durham against the king. William had other things on his mind and couldn't react straight away. The sons of Harold again raided the southwest from Ireland, but were eventually driven off, and had done nothing to increase their popularity with the locals. Given the damage they'd inflicted, they'd actually made themselves into the enemy. Edgar, Gospatric and his allies knew that their best chance for independence lay in the north. It was reassuringly distant from Normandy, as well as within the reach of their principal ally Malcolm in Scotland. It had a history of autonomy within the English kingdom, dominated by powerful earls, and the Scandinavian tradition there opened up further possibilities. In 1069, though, they realised that they needed to do considerably better than the previous year, and they had three further groups they needed to bring along with them. The first was a man called Waltheof, the youngest son of Earl Siward of Northumbria. He'd been made an Earl of Land around Huntingdon and Northamptonshire in 1065, and he would have been 16 in 1066. William had treated him generously, allowing him to keep his lands and status. But bringing Waltheof onto their side would give the rebels the credentials they needed to bring the Northumbrians to their side as well, and for whatever reason, they were able to talk the 19-year-old round into joining them. The second group was the Scandinavians. Because despite my grand assertion that we'd come to the end of the Viking Age in 1066 with the death of Harald Hardrada, the Danes seemed to lack that kind of 20-20 hindsight, so they continued to think that they could roll back time and relive the days of Canute the Great. Svein Estrithson now felt secure on the throne of Denmark and ready to challenge, and it's not until we get to the death of his son, Canute II, that the English kings can really turn their attention elsewhere. Svein therefore assembled a massive fleet of 240 ships, maybe 10,000 men, and sent his brother Osbun and his sons Harald and Canute. And the third group were the earls Edwin and Morcar, but this time, perhaps fatally, the earls refused to take part. The plan, simple enough, was to take York and proclaim Edgar king. We never get the chance to find out whether that was the extent of their ambitions, but I think we suspect not, and that London would have been next. Things kicked off in September, when the Danish fleet followed the traditional route to the north, appearing off the southeast coast and raiding Dover, Ipswich and Norwich as they went. But the results were disappointing by comparison with the past, as the raiders met the walls of the Norman castles. But nonetheless, by September the 8th, they appeared in the mouth of the River Humber, where they were joined by Edgar, Gospatric and Waltheof. So now William faced a threat of considerably larger scale than before. As always with northern revolts, the focus was York, and the Danes and rebels attacked the castle there. The Normans were led by a man called William Mallet, one of the men who had fought with William at Hastings and a major landowner. They fought with determination, firing all the houses around the castle to make sure that the Danes couldn't use the materials to fill up the ditch surrounding the castle. The rebels stormed the city on the 21st September, and the Normans were overwhelmed. Over 3,000 were killed, and only William Mallet and his daughter were allowed to go free. With England in flames, Edric the Wild realised that William had real trouble on his hands, and he took full advantage, attacking Shrewsbury with the help of his Welsh allies and rebels from Chester. William gathered his army and marched north. Florence of Worcester describes his mood by saying he had a heavy heart. Roger of Hoveden said his attitude was one of extreme irritation. Irritation is a lovely understatement, given what's coming next. Because William had now clearly decided that there was no more Mr. Nice Guy, and that if he was to survive, absolute brutality was going to be what he needed. He started with York, and his name alone made the Danes withdraw from York to the other side of the Humber. William detached a force to watch them, and then descended with lightning speed on Shropshire, defeated Edric, and forced him and his allies to scuttle back to Wales. While he was away, the rebels had once again occupied York, but William had no desire to see his men die against its walls. So instead, he began what would become known as the Harrying of the North, and which would be the one thing that seems to have troubled his conscience for the rest of his life. By devastating the area around York, William deprived the rebels of any food and supplies, and forced them to leave the city. Meanwhile, he sent messages to Osborne the Dane, and offered him a deal. We give you lots of money, you leave. Osborne leapt at the chance. He'd already demonstrated a complete lack of desire to fight the Normans. There was no food, and the rebels were probably whining. A good time to leave, then. Back in Denmark, Svein was furious, outlawed Osborne, and set sail to join and lead the fleet himself. But it was way too late for the Northumbrian rebels. They'd been chopped off at the knees, and they retreated before William's fury. William celebrated Christmas with studied and calculated pomp and largesse. He wore the crown and regalia which he'd brought up specially from London. All around him, the people of York and the surrounding countryside were starving, and his message was for them and for any future rebels. Don't take me on, because if you do, this is what'll happen. After Christmas, he just kept going north, killing and destroying as he went. Destroying crops, killing livestock, burning villages. The harrying of the north outraged and horrified even William's most ardent supporters in a hard age. No one seems to have a problem with the odd mutilation or blinding here and there, but this was different. The most staid of chroniclers breaks into flowing prose to condemn his brutality. I've put some of the longer quotes from Roger of Hoveden on the website, but here's the odd snippet. Roger has already described the devastation here, and now goes on to describe the impact. A famine prevailed to such a degree that, compelled by hunger, men ate human flesh, and that of horses, dogs and cats, and whatever was repulsive. And again, it was dreadful to behold human corpses rotting in the houses, streets and high roads, for there were not enough left to inter them. Odoric Vitalis, as I've already mentioned, is another chronicler, generally very well disposed to William, though quite well balanced. He wrote, "The king stopped at nothing to hunt his enemies. He cut down many people and destroyed homes and land. Nowhere else had he shown such cruelty. This made a real change." And again he wrote, "To his shame, William made no effort to control his fury, punishing the innocent with the guilty. He ordered that crops and herds, tools and food be burnt to ashes. More than 100,000 people perished of hunger. I have often praised William in this book, but I can say nothing good about this brutal slaughter. God will punish him." Odoric also recorded that even William himself came to realise the depth of his crime. Odoric records William's words on his deathbed. "I attacked the English of the northern shires like a lion. I ordered their houses and corn, with all their belongings, to be burnt without exception, and large herds of cattle and beasts of burden to be destroyed wherever they were found. It was there I took revenge on masses of people by subjecting them to a cruel famine, and by doing so, alas, I became the murderer of many thousands of that fine race." In point of fact, the harrying, though worse in the north, was also carried out in 1070 through large swathes of Mercia. And the evidence of the depth of the destruction is clear in the Domesday Book, where vast areas remain uncultivated and depopulated even 15 years later. But you have to say that he'd made his point, and hate it or loathe it, it worked pretty well. Edgar fled back to his brother-in-law in Scotland. Waltheof and Gospatric submitted to William, and hang me if they don't get a kiss on both cheeks, a chuck under the chin, and are told not to worry. Both are restored to their earldoms. Waltheof is even promised marriage to William's niece Judith. Presumably in the midst of this chaos and slaughter, William felt he still needed their local knowledge and influence, and was prepared to give it one more try. But he wouldn't be giving them another one after that. Meanwhile, remember Bishop Aylwin in Durham? Well, he ran round like a headless chicken for a while, disinterring the body of St Cuthbert and running for it with the bones of the saint, then coming back to Durham. But in the end, he died alone of starvation in a Norman prison. William may have regretted the harrying on his deathbed, but in 1070, he showed great signs of satisfaction. He paraded his army in May at Salisbury and paid off most of his mercenaries, which shows either a certain coolness, or maybe he knew that after 4 years of occupation, he could now rely on his feudal levies being forthcoming. He was confident that resistance was crushed. As it happens, he was wrong, but not very wrong. None of the rebellions that followed would threaten as much, and he'd be perfectly well able to cope. After 1070 then, William began to focus on setting his kingdom up in the way he wanted it, with the people he trusted, and those people did not include the English.